Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2007.
Welcome, Alex Ross. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Louise, for that introduction. It's very nice, and it's wonderful to be here. I've visited L.A. a number of times over the years, but I have to admit I've never actually been inside the public library, and it's a magnificent space. I have written a book called The Rest is Noise, Listening to the 20th Century. It's a cultural history of music since 1900, including not only descriptions of the works themselves, but also a great deal about the cultural background, what other artists in other art forms were doing at the same time through various periods of the century, what was going on socially, culturally, and politically. There is quite a bit of politics in the book, as befitting a century that includes in its cast of characters of those who came in contact with the major composers of the period, everyone from Kaiser Wilhelm to Joseph Stalin, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and Adolf Hitler, Joseph McCarthy, the Kennedys, and so on and so on. All of them make appearances in the book. Even J. Edgar Hoover shows up once or twice. So it is a sprawling narrative, and I worked quite hard to fit it between the covers of one hopefully not too humongous book. This talk is going to be something of an improvement on the book in that you will actually be able to hear the music. I will be moving very rapidly through a bewildering range of styles, and unfortunately I don't have any Dramamine to pass out, so just hold on. It's going to last about an hour. And I want to begin by talking about classical music. This is a book about classical composition in the 20th century. And of course, when people hear the phrase classical music, they tend to think of something like this. But this is also classical music. As is this. And this. Mr. Karlheinz Stockhausen. And this. Come back to that at the very end. Boccherini, Stravinsky, Gershwin, Stockhausen, and Osvaldo Galeoff. There is no one genre here, no one style, no one point of origin, philosophical or geographical. Particularly now, when a list of significant composers would include Galeoff, born in Argentina, Unsuk Chin, of South Korea, Frangis Alizadeh of Azerbaijan, and John Adams from exotic Berkeley, California. Composers are simply artists who react to the music of their time and music of past times and the community around them, and they create music about music, music extended from music, or alternately sounds of their own creation. What has happened in the 20th century is that composers have exploded every possible stereotype of what we mean by classical music. They've gone to every imaginable extreme, music of the purest beauty and music of the purest noise. They've become enmeshed in the machinery of the fascist state. They've written communist marching anthems. They've become stars of democratic culture. They've dropped out of society altogether and gone riding the rails as hobos. They will not be put in any sort of box, and this talk is essentially an attempt to defeat any preconceptions you may have about the subject. 20th century music is, for most people, an undiscovered country. It is also, from the standpoint of a historian, a goldmine of unbelievable personalities, charismatic, eccentric, absurd, sometimes very charming, of unbelievable situations and unlikely encounters and meetings. Composers have been placed in an extraordinary predicament in which they essentially have been found themselves unwanted from all sides. On the one hand, you have the committed classical audience for which modern music is something of an anathema and is simply not something that they're interested in hearing. This was underway already in the 19th century, where increasingly audiences were rejecting the new and even considered Brahms too difficult in his time. And then you have many others on the outside of classical music culture dismissing it as something irrelevant to their lives. You could easily tell it all as a tragic tale, one of a fall from a great height. But the paradox is that in this century, with its technologies of reproduction and broadcast, more people have heard classical music than at any time in history. So we don't know what's going to happen next. It could be the end of the story, or it could be the beginning of a new golden age. I'm inclined to think the latter, but it's up to you. When most people think of modern music, if they think of it at all, they usually think of something like this. Arnold Schoenberg's Five Pieces for Orchestra, number 4. What is happening here is atonality, the first of a number of terms that I'll try to fill in a little bit for those of you who haven't encountered them. You can define atonality very roughly as music that lacks the warm, familiar, basic chords of Western harmony, the major triad, the minor triad, and so on. Music that is characterized by new chords, often sharply dissonant ones. Music that is essentially an entirely new language, the equivalent of abstraction in painting and the stream of consciousness in literature. But these chords have a more shocking effect than, say, abstraction in painting, because sound itself is more visceral, more physical. It affects our bodies. It is a shaking of the air. It plays also to a captive audience that is stuck in the hall for the duration of the piece, as you are here. Unlike a viewer in a gallery who has the option of walking on to the next room and looking at another painting if he or she sees something not to his or her liking. This explains why there was such an extraordinary uproar when the first atonal or hyper-dissonant works were heard. Two famous occasions being a concert organized by Schoenberg in March 1913, which had to be stopped in the middle. The police were called, and there was a lawsuit that went on for some weeks in the Viennese courts. And, of course, the premiere of The Rite of Spring in Paris, also 1913, just a few weeks after that Schoenberg scandal concert. I begin my book not with Schoenberg, but with Richard Strauss, a really fascinating and ambiguous figure, an original thinker who was also a great entertainer. He knew how to keep the public on his side even as he provoked them. In 1905, he wrote the opera Salome, a setting word for word, almost, of Oscar Wilde's ultra-decadent play. And here his language took a turn that caught the attention of the young Schoenberg. It uses much material familiar from Wagner, but everything is sped up, nervous, agitated. One chord spills over to the next, into the next, with no apparent logic. There are sudden collisions, sudden dissonances, a sense of the ground beginning to go out from under one's feet. Schoenberg heard it in 1906 at the Austrian premiere, a remarkable occasion that I describe at the beginning of my book. Also present were Gustav Mahler. Here are Strauss and Mahler on that day. Mahler is in the black, and Strauss is looking very sporty in his boater hat. Giacomo Puccini was also there. Schoenberg's student Alban Berg and five other Schoenberg pupils, as I found by studying the guest lists that were published in the Graz newspapers for that week. And allegedly, the 17-year-old Adolf Hitler, who later told Strauss's son that he had made a special trip from Vienna to see the opera. Thomas Mann also mentions this performance in his novel Dr. Faustus, the story of a composer in league with the devil. Ah, I have kissed thy mouth, Yohanan. We are entering an eerie new landscape in music here. Schoenberg, here he is in his study with pictures of Mahler on the wall, hears this opera and sets to thinking about what secrets are contained in it. His own language has already grown very strained and sometimes very dissonant, and he goes on this private voyage which takes him into atonality. There are lots of things going on in Schoenberg's world. For one thing, he's part of a Viennese scene that includes some other very radical figures, the architect Adolf Loos, the artist Kokoschka and Schiele, the satirist Karl Kraus. Freud is also there analyzing the subconscious. All of these intellectuals and artists are in one way or another arrayed against the Viennese cult of art and beauty, the art for art's sake mentality that produces Art Nouveau and all those gilt facades on buildings in Vienna. For them, it was all a lie, concealing the harsh realities of society and those who are oppressed on the margins. That's one part of it. But there was also a particular crisis building in Schoenberg's soul. He was feeling abandoned and alone. Mahler, on whom he had become dependent, this powerful Jewish artist who had governed the court opera for 10 years, left for New York at the end of 1907. There, as you can see, pictures of his beloved mentor. 8 days after Mahler's departure, Schoenberg wrote the first piece that scholars designate as, at least to some degree, atonal. There's also insanity building in Schoenberg's personal life. His wife is having an affair with the painter Richard Gerstel, who gave Schoenberg lessons. Schoenberg began doing some quite striking paintings in an expressionistic style. This is a self-portrait, the red gaze. Schoenberg walked in on his wife and Gerstel in the summer of 1908. At exactly this time, he was finishing his second quartet, in which a soprano has a soprano soloist in the last two movements. And here he takes another big step away from music as we knew it. And he's reading the poetry of Stefan Georg, the German symbolist, who presents him with these strange, otherworldly, yet very pure and precise images that he wants to translate into sound. I feel the wind of another planet. The faces that had only just turned to me as friends grow pale through the darkness. Gerstel committed suicide in December 1908 on the night of a Schoenberg-sponsored concert to which he had not been invited. He hung himself in his studio naked in front of a mirror, having set his paintings on fire. The next month, by coincidence or not, Schoenberg begins writing music that has a new violence in it, in which the possibility of atonal music to really play on the nerve endings is unleashed. Schoenberg was a revolutionary. He was a brilliant and provocative composer. He was also a master polemicist and theorist, who in 1911 wrote a very shocking book entitled Harmonielehre, in which he said that tonality was dead. And indeed, it seems to be dead indeed, at least for the time being. Schoenberg was also a great teacher, and two of his students, Berg and Anton Webern, went on to become major figures in 20th century music history. There was a sizable difference between them, indicating the different paths that composers would follow in coming decades. Berg was one who looked back to the world that had just been declared dead. He had a certain nostalgia for that romantic vocabulary of Strauss and Mahler, and he never let go of it entirely, and with it, of tonality itself. This is evident in a climactic passage in his first opera, Wozzeck. After the title character dies, he goes into a pond trying to retrieve the knife with which he has just killed his wife and drowns. The captain and the doctor, who have done the main work of driving Wozzeck mad, walk by and see something happening. They're not sure what it is, and like good bourgeois, they move on, preferring not to be disturbed. Something totally extraordinary now happens as the orchestra plays a lamentation for the outcast anti-hero of the opera. Romantic tonality surges back into what had been a largely atonal score. Berg discovers that these twin extremes, the collision of consonance and dissonance, is the source of the most intense expression. Webern was different. He did not look back. Tonality was for him definitely kaput. "We broke its neck," he once said. In later years, he would devise a language in which atonality was compressed, atomized, to the point where movements of pieces lasted just a few minutes, even 30 or 40 seconds, pointillistic, crystalline, otherworldly, eerily beautiful in a through-the-looking-glass kind of way. But in 1909, the same year Schoenberg was writing his five pieces, Webern wrote his own six pieces for orchestra, which went one step farther. This is the ultimate atonal music, music that progressively obliterates the familiar that goes over the brink from music into noise. It was written as a memorial for the composer's mother, for whom he seemed to have very strong feelings. Thank you. Meanwhile, in Paris... Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. Stravinsky unleashes dissonances, but they are different from Schoenberg's. The chords are built up from little melodic fragments that swirl about, the themes often derived from Russian folk music, which Stravinsky studied closely, except that things happen not one after another, but on top of each other, or in rapid cinematic sequence. We are moving into the tempo of the 20th century, the age of technology and all-powerful machines, even though this is ostensibly a ballet of a primitive culture. There's ancient brutality and modern brutality. Stravinsky seems to suggest that we've always been the same rapacious species. So Stravinsky shocks everyone by writing this music, then he shocks everyone by never writing anything like it again. This composer's career is a long series of left turns, right turns, reverses, and leaps ahead. He's always taking pride in doing the unexpected thing and in never falling behind. It went on like that until his last years in the 1960s, by which time he was one of the most legendary people alive, a man who gave autographs on request to both Frank Sinatra and the Pope, who went to the Kennedy White House and had a little too much to drink, bothered President Kennedy about his taxes because he thought he was paying too much. And afterward, he got into his car and said to his wife, "Nice kids." Here's the man himself.
"And when I played this beginning of the second to Diaghilev, he was a little bit surprised to see this repetition of the chord so many times. He asked me only one thing, which was very offending. He asked me, 'Will it last a very long time this way?' And I said, 'Till the end, my dear.'"
During the First World War, when European civilization seemed to be enacting in real time the sacrifice depicted on the right, Stravinsky threw away all this heaviness of sound, these thick textures, and created music stripped down and fast like a motor car. Here are three pieces that he wrote in quick succession, any one of which could have been the basis for a whole career, and indeed, many composers who hung on Stravinsky's every word did just that. First, Histoire de Soldat from 1918. A newly objective, sharp-edged, unsentimental, anti-romantic music with a popular flavor. Here's the tango. Sort of a tango for 3:30 a.m. somewhere. Then, fast upon this, comes Puccinella from 1919-1920. This looks back to the pre-romantic past, especially the Baroque, rearranging pieces that were attributed to Pergolesi, finding in them new clarity and vigor. But then, Symphonies of Wind Instruments from 1920. Abstract, sculptured music, enigmatic but tactile, retaining this thingness that Stravinsky's music always had. French composers were thinking along the same lines in these years. No more romanticism, no more Bach heaviness and pomposity. A brilliant young man named Francis Poulenc, who grew up listening to the radical effusions of Schoenberg and Stravinsky, picked up the spirit in his early music, and he was at the core of that sassy gang called Les Six, who dominated French music in the 1920s. This is Poulenc's Les Biches from 1923. young German composers picked up this new informal, unsentimental tone. Those who had served in the war, like Paul Hindemith. Are we okay? couldn't go back to the big Wagnerian orchestra. They wanted to be cosmopolitan, with it, international. Even Schoenberg's expressionism now seemed out of date to them. Here's Hindemith's Kammermusik No. 2 of 1924, which is like Bach's Brandenburg Concertos souped up for the Roaring Twenties. It was nice to see solemn German composers getting a little crazy, as in Hindemith's Kammermusik No. 1. There's another major development in 20s music which has to do with folk-based modernism, the idea of taking folk music, any kind of traditional music, and treating it on its own terms. Don't clean it up and polish it and use it as thematic material for a four-movement symphony. Let the material determine the form. This was going on in Stravinsky's Right, and it really originated with the great Czech composer Leos Janáček, who was actually from a small Moravian village, and he made it his mission to meld his sophisticated compositional techniques with the raw rural music of his childhood. At the turn of the century, Janáček started working with very short motifs, obsessively repeated, and melodies that imitated the patterns of the Czech language. By the 1920s, he was writing music tough and grand and unlike anyone else's, as in the Glagolitic Mass. There's also Béla Bartók in Hungary, who grows up listening to Liszt and Richard Strauss and then leaps off in his own direction. In the summer of 1907, just at the time that Schoenberg was beginning to suspect that something was up with his wife, Bartók fell in love with a brilliant young violinist who rejected him. And he went off to the mountains of Transylvania to collect folk music and seemed to fall in love with the people instead, the folk, and devoted himself to assimilating the flexible rhythm and grainy texture and the emotional directness of peasant music. In the 20s, Bartók was listening to Schoenberg and Stravinsky and incorporated sharper dissonances and other tough new sounds into his language, but somehow he remained ever more true to his folk sources, as in the finale of the Fourth Quartet of 1928. There's also a kind of modernism that seeks to learn from popular music, from jazz, treating jazz as a kind of folk object. This was tricky because jazz was in the process of becoming an art music of its own, and it didn't necessarily need classical composers to elevate it. However, in 1923, Darius Milhaud wrote the ballet Création du Monde, Creation of the World, in which a saxophone jazz element is blended into a sophisticated Bachian background. Schoenberg, meanwhile, has a new idea. Navigating the chaos of atonality, he wants a rule to guide him, something with which to organize his material, and he comes up with 12-tone music. The idea is not to repeat any note in a series of 12 until all 12 have sounded, and to derive all thematic material from the interval relationships of the series. Schoenberg stumbled across the principle while writing Jakobsleiter, Jacob's Ladder, a big oratorio that he did not actually finish. In this excerpt, at the very beginning of the piece, you'll first hear a corkscrew figure involving six notes the remaining six of the set of 12 enter one after another in a rather forbidding stairway to heaven. Seven. Eight. Nine. Ten. 11 and 12. We've achieved total chromatic saturation. Twelve-tone writing allowed Schoenberg to relax a bit. He became even a bit conservative in his middle age. He resumed writing in old forms, concerto and serenade, quartet variations. Here is the waltz movement of his variations for orchestra. Very Viennese. Finally, there is, in this rambunctious decade of the 1920s, political music, left-wing music. Kurt Weill, like many others, wants to write music for the masses, music for the working classes, and he goes further than most in rejecting classical grandiosity and assimilating popular forms. In league with Bertolt Brecht, he writes the Three Penny Opera. Here is Brecht himself singing. And then there is Hans Eisler, a full-bore communist who goes into bars and rough neighborhoods of Berlin with his favorite collaborator, the singer, shouter, actor Ernst Busch, and he develops quite a following, at least before the Nazis come in and bring it all to an end. Here is Der Heimliche Aufmarsch, the secret mobilization from 1930.
Arbeiter, horch, sie ziehen ins Feld und schreien für Nation und Rasse. Das ist der Krieg der Herrscher der Welt.
This is the war of the rulers of the world against the working classes.
Der Angriff gegen die Sowjetunion.
The attack on the Soviet Union.
Ist der Stoß ins Herz der Revolution.
It's a stab in the heart of the revolution.
Der Krieg, der jetzt durch die Länder geht.
And the war. Hit the fascists. It makes you want to go out and kill for Stalin, doesn't it? Of course, one must take care in hitting fascists that one does not become fascist oneself. We are now in the period of the 1930s and 40s, the period of the New Deal in America, Stalin's Soviet Union, and Hitler's Germany. That is a picture, disturbingly, of Hitler listening to music. These centralized states produced a new kind of centralized music. Composers were encouraged, or in some cases forced, to write a music that had broad appeal, not in the sense of Weill's subversive pop songs, but in the sense of music that used, say, symphonic form. This was a period of many, many symphonies, after the model of Beethoven, to speak for the national spirit. And this would be a music that could be broadcast on the radio and used on movie soundtracks and be comprehensible to all. The political differences among these various cultures were severe, but the music often sounded curiously alike, especially in the case of America and the Soviet Union. In the quasi-socialistic New Deal period, many artists looked to their Soviet counterparts as models, not realizing that the Soviet Union was something less than the utopia advertised. Chief among these was Aaron Copland, who, after a modernistic, jazz-tinged period, wrote a series of populist works that tried to capture the wide, open American landscape, the prairie and the old frontier, and also included a progressive, anti-capitalist agenda beneath the surface. Copeland was Jewish, gay, communist-leaning. He looked like an insurance adjuster in a Hollywood genre picture, but he somehow invented the sound that people think of as purely American and which has been imitated in a million movie scores and feel-good commercials. Here is the very familiar Appalachian Spring. The familiarity of the sound should not distract anyone from the fact that Copeland was a very great composer. We need to forget the associations, the Morning in America commercials and so on, to realize how perfectly economical in construction and precise in expression this music was. There is never a wasted note. Back in the USSR, things were not as happy as they seemed to admiring American journalists. Dmitri Shostakovich was the brilliant young man of Soviet music who burst on the scene in 1920s with music that reflected the raucous, sardonic spirit of early Bolshevik art. And by the 1930s, Stalin was in power, dominating life and bringing artists under control. The idea was to write socialist realist music that would celebrate the Soviet state in a more conservative vocabulary so that all could understand. Shostakovich made fitful attempts to assimilate this instruction. In the opening of his Fourth Symphony, maybe hear something of the spirit of industrialization and electrification, the five-year plan, the great workers' projects, the building of dams, the heroic overachieving efforts of the Stakhanovites, and so on. But there is something vaguely wrong with the picture. In 1936, after finishing the first two movements of this symphony, Shostakovich experienced a huge setback. His opera Lady Macbeth was denounced in the pages of Pravda 2 days after Stalin went to see it. Here is the climactic passage of the symphony. People have been arguing for some time now about Shostakovich's Stalin-era music, whether it celebrates the regime or critiques it. But like all great music, Shostakovich's works possess an ambiguity and an ambivalence that make them open to appropriation and misappropriation by multiple points of view. There is not too much doubt, though, I think, that he was here feeling something exceedingly dark. Germany was governed by a committed music lover who listened appreciatively to classical music. Richard Strauss was flattered by the attention that Hitler bestowed on him. He took a post in the cultural machinery early on and lent his considerable prestige to the Nazi cause. He came to regret those decisions, though after a while it seemed as though he had no choice. His son married a Jewish woman, and his grandsons were considered fully Jewish, and he did what he had to do to protect them. By 1945, Strauss was almost a broken man, though one who was still writing extraordinary music. On April 12, 1945, he finished Metamorphosen for 23 strings. This was Strauss's memorial for Germany, for German culture, which he believed was at an end. Hitler had destroyed most of it. This very unsettling photograph shows a performance of Pavel Haas's study for strings at the Theresienstadt camp in 1944. He's there taking a bow. A few months before he and most others seen in the picture were killed at Auschwitz. By 1945, Allied bombs were finishing the job of wiping out the Germany of Strauss's childhood. As it happens, on that same April 12th, Franklin Delano Roosevelt died, and many radio stations marked the occasion by playing Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings, which is strangely similar in sound to what Strauss had just composed. Everything was different after 1945. Allied forces took control of Germany and began reorganizing German musical life. Here is a memo from the files of OMGUS, the Office of Military Government, United States, Music Control Instruction Number 1, saying that we should encourage music that we think beneficial and crowd out that which we think dangerous. In the dangerous category was Richard Strauss, who found himself under American jurisdiction in his Alpine villa in Garmisch. This is a postcard that the composer signed for an American soldier, Private Russell Campitelli, who gave the picture to me, on June 23, 1945. And this is a picture that the soldier oboist, John Delancey, took of Strauss at around the same time. It was for Delancey that Strauss wrote his Oboe Concerto, one of a number of remarkable periods that he wrote, pieces that he wrote in his very last years. Back home, the advent of the Cold War put new pressures on composers who had been leaning strongly to the left in the previous decades. Here is Hans Eisler, defiant before a congressional hearing. Here is a page from Aaron Copland's FBI file. J. Edgar Hoover is keeping track of what flights Copland is using to enter and leave the United States. Good thing this kind of thing doesn't happen anymore. The English composer Benjamin Britten had an FBI file too, which is remarkably uninformative. And Copland and Leonard Bernstein were featured in Life magazine as dupes and fellow travelers in such distinguished company as Thomas Mann and Albert Einstein and Charlie Chaplin, just out of the picture there in the upper right-hand corner. The young composers, especially the Europeans who had witnessed terrible things fighting as teenagers in the last years of the war, wanted to reject the past and start absolutely fresh. Schoenberg's 12-tone language became very fashionable at a time when German romanticism seemed to have been contaminated by fascism and that populist mode that was used in America in the 1930s and 1940s so widely, that seemed to have been contaminated by totalitarian communism. 12-tone writing seemed pure, uncontaminated, a medium of radical truth in a world ruled by propaganda. Milton Babbitt was one of the leaders of this new mentality. Here is his three compositions from 1947, 1948. A rather jazzy American form of 12-tone writing. Babbitt later undertook an expansion of the 12-tone system so that it applied not only to notes, but to dynamic levels, registers, the durations of notes, all organized into series of 12. The same tendencies crop up in the music of the radical young Europeans, Pierre Boulez and Karlheinz Stockhausen, here seen at the Darmstadt Summer Courses for New Music. Hold it on there, Milton. There might be something symbolic about all the empty chairs, I'm not sure. And it was at Darmstadt where the chief breakthroughs of the post-war avant-garde were unveiled. Music was fragmenting, atomizing, becoming a pointillistic art at the far end of abstraction. This is Boulez's first piano sonata from 1946. Composers are also exploring the possibilities of electronic music. There are German magnetic tape machines circulating around formerly occupied Europe, and these allow for experiments that earlier technologies would not have permitted. Pierre Schaeffer in Paris records the sounds of locomotives and stitches them together into a tape composition, a style of working that comes to be known as musique concrète. German composers in the electronic studio work on synthesizing sound for the first time rather than recording sounds outside and bringing them into the studio. Herbert Eimert and Stockhausen are in the studio in Köln during 1952-1953, performing pioneering experiments in this field. Here is Eimert's Klangstudie 2, the source of all the synth pop hits of tomorrow. In New York, John Cage and Associates. Here, Cage is seen cavorting with Stockhausen. Spend 6 months or more cutting and splicing tape, using chance procedures to decide which piece of tape should be chosen next, to come up with Williams Mix, also 1952. It is just a few minutes long, but it took the better part of a year to create. These days, with laptop computers, you could do it all in a few minutes. In this period, we also have composers attacking the concept of pitch itself, dissolving it into fields of tone, texture, timbre. Yanis Xenakis, an expatriate Greek communist who had part of his face blown off by a British shell in fighting at the end of the war, eventually fled to Paris and wrote Metastases, 1953-1954, using a very complex, elaborate method of statistical analysis, studying how shapes can emerge from myriad points of data. And despite the technical complexity of the procedure, the music itself is hypnotic, even seductive on the surface, though of course also very strange and more than a bit scary. The pressure to be progressive, not to fall behind, was enormous in this period. Stravinsky had never paid serious attention to 12-tone music, but now, in the 1950s, he took it up, although he used it in a very Stravinsky way. Copland, too, adopted a version of the Schoenberg method. In 1962, he shocked everyone with his Connotations for Orchestra, which was played at the gala opening of the Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts in 1962. It was no Appalachian Spring. There's a great story involving the premiere of Connotations in which Jackie Kennedy is a participant. The piece appeared in the first half of the program, and backstage, Mrs. Kennedy, who had come up to New York for the affair, ran into Copland, and she was normally very at ease in cultural situations, but in this case, she couldn't think of anything to say, and she looked at Copland and said, "Oh, Mr. Copland. Oh, Mr. Copland." That's my famous Jackie Kennedy impersonation. thank you. Music became ever more extreme as the 50s gave way to the 60s. Scores began to resemble graphic art. Cage invented the happening, leading to a new subgenre of composition as performance art. This is Philip Korner's Piano Activities, and yes, the piano is being sawed in half. But it's wrong to think of this period simply as a long bacchanal of experiment and extreme activity. Active in the same period was Benjamin Britten, who in his great cycle of operas and song cycles used ostensibly traditional forms to explore some very potent and unsettling psychological states, as well as to write some bewitchingly beautiful music. He spent almost all of his life in the small town of Aldeburgh on the East Anglian coast, holding himself aloof from the continental centers of new music, which didn't want anything to do with him anyway. Here's the chorus, "On the Ground Sleep Sound," from his setting of A Midsummer Night's Dream. This music is, by the way, 12-tone music of an eccentric kind. The four chords underpinning the fairy chorus add up to a 12-tone row. And there was Olivier Messiaen, who taught Boulez, Stockhausen, and Xenakis, and in the 50s wrote some music of quite ferocious complexity, but who then returned to the lush, although never conventional, tonal language in which he had first found his voice in the 20s and 30s. He was commissioned to write a piece for the bicentennial of the United States, and he chose to celebrate the canyons of Utah, which he is here seen exploring. The result was the huge instrumental cycle From the Canyons to the Stars, which ends with a climactic section titled Zion Park, in which the plain old major and major triad sound again, transfigured by the intense spiritual imagination of the man I consider the greatest religious composer after Bach. Tonality was dead, Schoenberg said. Even he didn't quite believe that in the end. But how do you write tonal music that doesn't sound nostalgic, like rewarmed Viennese pastry? Britten, Messiaen, and Leonard Bernstein, among many others, solved this problem in their individual ways. But the most radical solution came on the west coast of America. Since almost the beginning of the century, there had been an alternative stream, a West Coast sensibility in music, pursuing a very different agenda from its East Coast and European counterparts. Back in 1912, a man named Charles Seeger, the father of Pete Seeger and the Seeger family of musicians, arrived at UC Berkeley and came up with an entirely new curriculum based on the study of folk music, popular music, non-Western music, as well as the latest European modernist notions. One of his students was Henry Cowell, who was a sort of child prodigy avant-gardist who had written cluster chords, very dense bunches of notes into his music at a very early date, and who now became a great alternative voice in music with his love of non-Western sounds and his non-goal-driven method of assembling a piece. This is Aeolian Harp, in which Cowell asks the pianist to use only the inside, the strings of the piano. There's also Harry Partch, who was born in the Arizona desert and comes to LA, takes up the study of tuning, and decides to reject the whole system of tuning that had prevailed for hundreds of years, inventing his own scales and his own instruments to play them. He not only drops out of Western music history, but out of Western society. For several years, he becomes a hobo, riding the rails during the Great Depression, and his music is influenced by hobo culture.
January 26th. I'm freezing. Ed Fitzgerald, age 19, 5 feet 10 inches, black hair, Boston, Boston, Massachusetts. It's 4 and I'm hungry and broke.
The texts of this song cycle, Barstow, come from inscriptions that Partch found on a highway railing outside Barstow, California. Later in the 1950s comes Lamont Young. He was born in Idaho in a log cabin, part of a tiny Mormon community. Goes to L.A. and becomes a saxophonist. He actually beats out Eric Dolphy for a spot in the L.A. City College jazz band. He encounters Cage and Darmstadt. He falls in love with the music of Webern, the very refined and esoteric 12-tone scores of Webern, but he goes against their spirit. He stretches out serial 12-note patterns to extraordinary length, so something that might unfold in just a few minutes or 30 seconds in a Webern piece takes an hour. It is called long tone music, and it is the beginning of what comes to be known as minimalism. If we were to listen to another minute or so, you might hear a new note. Young is dismissed as a nut in Berkeley, which is an achievement. And he goes to New York, where he starts curating concerts in Yoko Ono's loft downtown. Yep, there it is. He writes a piece that consists of an open fifth, to be held for a long time. That's all that the score says. He sets up a theater of eternal music in which he and musicians spend hours improvising over drones, inventing peculiar tunings, playing along with the electronic frequencies produced by the instruments, the equipment. This music is very far out. There's a certain drug culture attached to it. Young was supposedly a very good connection if you were after a certain kind of experience. Back in California, Terry Riley was playing with tape loops, tape delay, building long processes from repeating patterns. In 1964, he wrote In C, in which a group of players build up a great hootenanny of sound from a small group of preset patterns. Again, it takes a long time for these minimalist pieces to develop, and if we skip ahead a few minutes, you begin to hear the mini melodies emerging. Skipping ahead again. Playing keyboards at the first performance of In C was a young New York composer, Steve Reich, who had come out to study at Mills College. He was very taken at first with the usual 12-tone and post-12-tone avant-garde European ideas, but he was also listening to a lot of pop music. His playlist at the time included not only Bach's Brandenburg Concertos and Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, but Miles Davis' So What? Coltrane, Africa. James Brown. And Bob Dylan. John is in a basement mixing up the medicine. What all this music has in common is a certain droning intensity, an insistence on a repeating figure or ostinato pattern or a single chord, and all this information from different sources suggested where Reich should go in his music. One of Reich's fellow students at Mills was a guy named Phil Lesh, who was writing super complex orchestral pieces in the manner of Stockhausen's Gruppen. One night he dropped acid while listening to Mahler's Sixth Symphony and was never quite the same again and ended up in the Grateful Dead. Reich decided to stick with composition, and one day he was sitting in front of a tape recorder working with a recording he'd made of a preacher delivering doomy prophecies in San Francisco's Union Square.
He began to warn the people. He said, after a while, it's going to rain after a while, for 40 days and for 40 nights. And the people didn't believe him, and they began to laugh at him, and they began to mock him, and they began to say, it ain't going to rain! It's gonna rain, 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 it's gonna rain.
And he'd set up two identical pieces of tape with this repeating phrase on two adjacent tape recorders and was working out some effect to do with them when he noticed that one tape recorder was running slightly faster than the other. The two voices are going slowly out of phase. He had the brilliant idea now of applying this principle of two identical looping patterns, one running slightly faster than the other, to instrumental music. In piano phase, 1966, 1967, two pianos start in unison. And then they go their separate ways, skipping ahead about 2 minutes. Shortly afterward, Philip Glass starts working with repeating patterns, though with different methods, and minimalism is fully underway. Within a few years, Reich was thinking on a broader scale, and he writes what's generally considered the minimalist masterpiece, which we were listening to as you came in. Music for 18 Musicians, 1976. Now something really interesting happens. The composers who'd been influenced by pop now influenced pop themselves. The Velvet Underground grew straight out of Lamont Young's improvising ensemble. Brian Eno and David Bowie listen to this kind of music and learn a great deal from it. They attend Reich and Glass concerts in London. The consequences continue to play out in popular music today. The final chapter of my book begins with an interview with John Adams. His early career tells, in a way, the story of the whole 20th century in miniature. He grew up listening to the symphonies of Sibelius, who's a very important part of my narrative and is being celebrated now at the LA Philharmonic. Then, in college, he studied with Leon Kirchner, a student of Schoenberg, and joined the ranks of the avant-garde. He then got into a VW Bug and drove to San Francisco, where he emulated John Cage and perpetrated various happenings, and then heard the early minimalist pieces and had a great idea. He would take the minimalist vocabulary and combine it with some of the great forms of the musical past, the symphonic and operatic traditions, and use it to renovate those institutions to make them absolutely contemporary. He was reading Schoenberg's text Harmony Lehre, a source of the proclamation that tonality was dead. In 1985, he wrote his own piece entitled Harmony Lehre, in which he said, essentially, like hell it is. But Adams is only one facet of music today. As the century comes to an end and the new century begins, no movement in music seems more significant or more progressive than any other. At the moment, styles of every description, minimalism, post-minimalism, electronic music, laptop music, internet music, thorny movements called new complexity and spectralism, doomy collage pieces and mystical meditations out of Eastern Europe and Russia, appropriations of rock, pop, and hip-hop, new experiments in folkloristic music in the Middle East, Latin America, East Asia, they all jostle against each other, and none is achieving supremacy. And in retrospect, we realize that the 20th century was always a time of many streams, a delta, in the wise words of John Cage. Interactions between classical composers and pop artists seem very lively right now, especially among the younger composers who no longer feel any resentment of the total domination of popular music in the commercial sphere. In the last few years, the borders between certain areas of popular music and certain areas of classical music have become rather blurry. If I told you that the following was the work of an Icelandic post-spectralist composer named Gudmundsdottir, I might have you going for a second before the voice came in. Conversely, this piece from Osvaldo Golyov's song cycle Aire, which you heard a bit of at the very beginning, sounds very much like pop, and with it I will end as an indication, perhaps, of where we're going in the future. That's the 20th century. Thank you very much. So we have a few minutes. I ran over by about 9 minutes, but we have some time for questions. Yep.
Two questions. First, did you consider adding a CD to your book? And second, I'm wondering about the question of nomenclature and your use of the word classical and new music. One of the biggest problems for me is trying to figure out what to call this anymore. And
yep.
How did you decide what to do, or did you just decide to make it simple?
Right. Well, first of all, we weren't actually able, for various reasons, budgetary, technical, and otherwise, to include a CD in the book. There's also the matter of getting rights to all this music. But I do have some pages on my website, therestisnoise.com. And if you go there on the right-hand side, you can click on audio files. And I've set up pages for each chapter, and each page has 8 or 10 or more samples, sometimes brief, sometimes longer, of a lot of the same pieces I played tonight and many more. And I'm hoping that's going to be a nice guide for people as they read the book, although it's a little hard to read and be on the internet at the same time. But you can sort of check in from time to time. And in terms of classical music, I don't like the term, but we're stuck with it. I mean, it does sum it up instantly. The sort of Luigi Boccherini world that I played right at the beginning, and it really technically only applies to music from Vienna, or in the spirit of Viennese classicism in the latter part of the 18th century, Mozart, Haydn, Mozart, and early Beethoven. And, you know, if you consider this huge span of achievement that goes from Hildegard von Bingen at the beginning of the millennium to this Galeoff music that I just played at the end, and that includes Baroque music, classical, romantic, symphonic, Wagner, and this explosion of styles in the 20th century, it really is hard to come up with a name for it. And I just consider it, you know, what composers do, whatever composers come up with. And these days, I think there are people on the pop side, and there have always been people on the pop side, who act very much like composers, sort of standing back and looking at the whole landscape and combining things in unexpected ways, going back to the first masters of jazz, who have every right to be considered composers. So the definitions get quite vague. I sort of arbitrarily decided I needed to keep the focus of this book on quote-unquote classical composition, but hopefully I'm aware constantly of everything else that's being written and produced in music and all the neighboring genres, because the boundaries are quite sketchy. Yeah, all the way in the back there.
First off, thank you for being a Franz Schreker advocate.
Oh, thank you. You're very welcome.
My question is, out of the 13 recordings of Zalame that you own, which is your favorite?
My favorite of the audio-only recordings is the Hildegard Behrens version with Karajan conducting, which I played the sample of there. I particularly like that recording because of Karl Walter Böhm, who sings the part of Herod. And Herod is often cast, is a part given to an aging tenor who kind of shrieks and camps his way through the role. And this is a much more lyrical voice, and it brings out a whole other sinister, fascinating dimension to the piece. This character of Herod, who has this marvelous, slippery, stylistically unstable music written for him. And that's a very important ingredient, which is overlooked when people are casting Salome. So I think that's actually the reason that I love that recording, aside from Behrens, who delivers the part quite grippingly. But I said audio only. There's also the DVD now of Teresa Stratus in Salome, and I think that would have to be considered supreme, because she's such an incredible actress, and there's just stuff in there which is, you know, really you should not be showing to your children. Yeah, over there.
Hey, Alex. It's Anne. Hi. You know, when you said that thing at the end of your talk, yeah, I got my hair cut, about there being no one school or one dominant form, it really struck me because I feel that's exactly what's going on in pop right now. Mm-hmm. And maybe a more recent development in pop, like we've seen sort of the end of hip-hop completely dominating, and it's an open field. And I just wondered about why you thought that was the case. Like, why is there, and you can take this, you know, beyond classical if you want, but you know, why is it that there isn't a strong dominant strain at the moment, or school?
Yeah, Ann Powers of the LA Times. I think it has something to do with, I mean, in classical music, since its events moved so quickly in the 20th century, and people were racing to extremes one after another, and just mapping out this landscape of possibilities as rapidly as possible, and in competition with one another, there's a sort of a atmosphere of an arms race almost, especially after the Second World War, and I think then, in sort of the last 20 years of the century, people have drawn back and say, "Wait, you know, let's go back and retrace our steps a little bit and fill in some of the territory that we raced through so quickly earlier in the century. You know, like an expedition which you know races across an unknown continent, and then slowly the landscape is mapped in detail. And I think that's what's been going on. Just a lot of reconsideration." And synthesis, obviously the idea that tonality had died is untenable, but that doesn't mean we throw out all of Schoenberg's inventions and everything that came in Schoenberg's wake. We just have a new context for them. And yeah, just a period of synthesis, as well as minimalism, which was this really, really important moment of going back to square one and starting with the simplest possible materials and seeing what kind of complex structures can be built up from them. So, you know, a case of just events moving very fast and now composers are just moving in all directions and filling in the picture. But I think it also has something to do with, I don't know, information being distributed so readily. So kind of a young composer growing up in some suburb can pick up a CD or now go on the internet and find out what you know the spectralists in Paris are doing, or Frangi Salezadeh in Azerbaijan, or John Luther Adams up in Alaska, and you know everything is just globalized and sort of coursing from one place to another, and this obviously has a lot to do with the decentering of the musical scene, and. You know, and the internet has accelerated all that and made it really impossible for any you know any musical movement to consider itself the center. So, you know, and I assume all you know very similar forces can be seen in pop and explaining the and also the fact that now these conversations are going on between classical and pop at a faster rate maybe than before.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakci Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC, 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.